Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
This is the year 1977, and my husband and I were newlyweds, had only been married about a year or two, so we were young and impressionable and full of energy.
Hi, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and this is Silvana Clark. She's an author and a corporate trainer, but back then she had a different idea of how she was going to make money.
We were living in Bellingham. We had a nice little house, but it's then when I heard just the tail end of a radio interview of this man talking about this book he wrote that was called Remodel Houses and Become a Millionaire. And back then, you know, it's true, people, you'd buy a house and we expected to live in our house for 20 or 30 years. That's just what you did. And he was saying, no, you buy a house and you fix it up and you sell it and then you use the money and build another and soon you'll be a millionaire. And, you know, back in the 70s, $1 million was a lot. That really was. And so since I heard this tail end of the interview, we thought, that's what we're going to do. First, I bought his book. But the problem is I never really read it. We kind of skipped through it and went, oh, yeah, you're supposed to paint. And okay, we'll do that. But he was very clear in saying you're supposed to buy a house that was just maybe cosmetically challenged. And the house we bought was way more than cosmetically challenged. It was way more than we should have ever done.
Sometimes the promise of a big payday can, shall we say, cloud our judgment. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is It's Only Money. Debts repaid and debts defaulted, printing money and throwing it away. But first, back to Silvana Clark's foolproof plan to get rich quick, flipping houses before it was cool.
We found this house and it was a good deal, see? So we figured, okay, if it's low price to buy it, then we'd make more profit. This was in Bellingham in a beautiful location. It was close to town, but surrounded by acres and acres of woods. We just maybe had a half an acre with the house, but there was nothing around it. And yet 10 minutes, we were downtown Bellingham. So it was a perfect location. Now it needed a new foundation. There were holes in the roof. The walls were covered with mold, and there were bullet holes in the windows. So that's just the beginning of what it looked like. And every day when we started working, the police helicopter would come and would fly overhead, circle, circle, and left. So I called the police. I said, what's going on? And they said, well, what's your address? I gave it to them, and the police officer said, I'm so glad you live there now. That's the headquarters for the Bandidos. Bandidos are a motorcycle club, and we would have to fly over every day because there were all these drug deals and all these parties, and it was a horrible place, and we're so happy that you're living there now. So they stopped flying over our house. We decided to start with the foundation. Now, we wanted to be do-it-yourselfers and save money. So Alan, my husband, he thought, well, we can just, one side of the house was about 5 inches lower than the other. He said, well, we'll just jack it up using the car jacks from our Honda Civic. So we went under the house with our two car jacks, and he kind of got them underneath, and then he's pushing and pushing on that little handle, and I have these cement blocks ready because we're thinking he'll lift up this whole two-story house, and I'll just put blocks underneath, and that will fix the foundation. But the house didn't budge, so that didn't really work. Well, then we decided to do the drywall, and the house was just covered with mold. So I tried soap and water, and that didn't work. So I just said, well, I'm using straight bleach. So I used straight bleach, and I'm wiping down these walls, and I had the doors open, but I thought, you know, these fumes would probably kill me, but we have bullet holes in the windows, so that's really nice. This gives us fresh air. So again, I'm looking at it as this is a positive thing. The upstairs bathroom, the floor was kind of sinking, and Alan couldn't figure out how to get the floor to not sink. So he got this big heavy-duty chain and he bolted it to the bottom of the floor, and then he brought it up to the ceiling, to the rafter that held up the roof, and pulled it tight. And so this chain was in the bathroom, but we just hung little, I put little pieces of ivy in and out of this chain, but it was actually holding up the floor of the bathroom. Alan and my brother tried to re-roof it themselves, and they did find it was too steep, and they tried patching, they were sliding off. Alan had harnesses made that he attached to the chimney. The chimney would start to crumble, so that didn't hold him if he fell. So we did get a professional for that. So we weren't totally ignorant. So we just kept going forward, and about the last thing we kind of did, we knew it needed new insulation. And there are these like 16-inch cavities with a stud on each side, and then you have to fill it. And we saw it was pretty much empty, the insulation. So again, we rented a machine and got this 25-pound bag of this fluffy insulation and poured it in the machine. It's like a big barrel. And we took it up to the attic, like it explained, and then you put a hose at the very top. And this insulation was supposed to come down, and we were doing a bathroom, through the 16-inch cavity. This insulation would come down. And so we blew it and kept blowing it, and this cavity never filled up. And we used the whole bag, and the bag was actually supposed to do half a room. And we couldn't figure this out because it was just a little cavity, 8 foot high. And then we got smart, and we started looking, and we realized the insulation had gone from the upstairs bathroom all the way down to the bottom of the house into the crawl space at the bottom of the house. And as it came down, it also brought with it some of the old insulation, which was all asbestos. So we had asbestos and insulation all down the crawl space, but we wanted to redeem some of that insulation. So we had bags, and we went down and we crawled down on our stomachs, because it's always good to crawl in asbestos. And we tried to scoop up some of this insulation that was at the bottom, but that's where we found raw sewage. That moment we kind of thought, you know, we're probably in over our heads, but we did like the location. We figured we could sell it for a lot of money. But as it turned out, we spent about a year and a half getting that house so it was kind of livable, and then we ended up living there 16 years, and we never became millionaires. You know, life happens. We adopted an 8-year-old girl, and so then we kind of started we spent more time with her than working on the house, and we thought, you know, she needs the stability of a school and a house, and so life kind of takes over, and so it wasn't really hard for us on that standpoint.
Silvana Clark is an author, corporate trainer, and storyteller. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is It's Only Money. So the year is 1982, and Mike Lewis is 16 years old. Mike's a journalist and a tavern owner in Seattle, but at this time he was living in Modesto, California.
And my brother Wayne had a 1968 Triumph TR250, and it is a small 6-cylinder British sports car that they only imported in the United States for 1 year. Wayne was the guy in the family who loved foreign sports cars. And back in the early 80s, these were not pricey things. In fact, they were not highly regarded at all, you know. But I loved Wayne, and I loved sports cars.
Wayne is 11 years older than Mike, the oldest of the 5 kids, and a role model.
Everyone in the family would agree on one point. Wayne is the best possible outcome of our gene pool.
As Mike picks up the story, Wayne had moved away from Modesto, but he and his 68 Triumph came back home for a visit.
And so he's home, and now, unfortunately, I have a driver's license. And so Wayne says, hands me the keys, and says, hey, take it for a spin. And I was like vibrating. I was so excited because I loved this car. So Wayne gives me the keys to the car, and there's a little lap you could do in our, well, I guess maybe the police would refer to it as a lap, but a little lap we would do in the neighborhood. And I did the lap kind of quickly, and I'm like, oh, this is easy. I can definitely do that faster. Second time around, I do a lap in the neighborhood. The rear end started to slide out, snapped back the other direction. The car went, up an embankment, got airborne. I was probably doing 40 miles an hour, and hit a walnut tree full speed. I hit the tree so hard that my face bent the steering wheel forward. It pushed my braces up into my gums, knocked out a tooth, and crushed the car. The other downside is I have the top down in this car, is that it was in the middle of walnut harvest season, and it filled the car with walnuts immediately when I hit the tree so hard that the entire tree dumped probably about 200 pounds of walnuts directly. It filled the car with walnuts around me. And so I'm kind of in shock. My mouth is bleeding like crazy. I've broken a couple of things. I climb out of the car, which is about a foot deep in mud in this orchard, which had been being irrigated at the time, and walk through the mud and run home. And my brother sees me and sees my mouth bleeding and says, "What happens?" I was mortified. Not only was I in physical pain, I was crushed. I mean, I was crying, and it was really hard on me when I was home because I realized I destroyed this thing. And none of us had any money. Wayne wasn't rich. My family definitely wasn't. My dad and my brother never once said a crossword to me about it, never once brought it up, never once said, "You blew it," never once berated me about it. Wayne didn't do anything other than say, make sure I was okay, looked at his car, was quiet about it, and then the next day, whatever money he had left, bought some ugly Ford sedan that he ended up driving. And this was, 37 years ago. And that was his last sports car. I would think about this several times a month. I would see a car, I would see something arbitrary, I'd think about Wayne, and it bugged me. And I don't know why. It became clear that it was a burr in my brain. It was not going away anytime soon. It was probably about 12 or 13 years ago, I thought, all right, well, I'm meeting my bills. I'm not saving a whole lot of money, but I can definitely find an account somewhere and put money into it and ignore it. And so that's what I started doing. Over the course of years, like if I had an extra $100, an extra $50, it would just go into this thing. So last summer, I am at a barbecue at my friend Laura's house. Laura's dad is a British car enthusiast. And I tell him about crashing my brother's car. And he says, "Well, you know, Tom Eller over there, he ran the British car repair shop here in Seattle for 40 years, has one of these cars and knows everything about them. If you think you want to try to find one again, Tom's your guy." So I walk over and talk to Tom for the next 3 hours. Tom gets me connected with the TR250 owners group, because there are so few of these that everyone in the country kind of knows everyone else who has one, or knows how to work on them, or knows how to get parts for them. And so I get on this and I post a brief version of this story. And I don't know, like 3 weeks later, a guy named Andrew Holiday from Oklahoma City messages me through Facebook and says, "Hey," he says, "Hey, I might have a car for you." So I say, "Well, send me some pictures." And so he does. And it's exactly it. I mean, it's exactly like my brother's car. It could not have been, it would have been impossible for it to be any closer than being the actual car. And I message him back and I say, "Yeah, I'm interested." And he said, "Well, I've already got it promised to somebody else, but he hasn't come up with the money. So I'll let you know." So he calls me back, I don't know what it was, a week later. And the guy had gotten into a car accident in his own car and now couldn't afford to buy this one. So it was a lot more money than I thought than I had saved. But I had other money in another savings account that I could tap to get this. These cars have become, over time, every old car from the 60s, they've become much more valuable than they were when I was young. I said, "All right, we make a deal." So I have the car delivered to my buddy Jim's house, high school buddy, who lives in Sunol, California. It's right next to Pleasanton in the East Bay. Jim remembers when I crashed Wayne's car. And he said, absolutely, I'm all in. And so he was pretty excited to be part of this whole thing. Now, no one in my family knows I'm doing this. And I get the car delivered there, and Jim, you know, sends me a picture of it and says, it's perfect. It looks great. So I then fly down to California, and I look at the car, and it's like, it was unbelievable. It smelled like my brother's car. I get on the road. I look down as I'm driving, and Jim had put a walnut on the passenger seat as a surprise for me, which I thought was pretty funny. All I've done with my family is I've arranged everyone to get together for dinner. It was supposed to be Wayne had just retired. And as a backstory on Wayne, Wayne had had a really rough year. Wayne had had a condition that forced him to retire. So we get everyone, we're supposed to meet in a Mexican restaurant in Modesto. And I pull up into the parking lot. Everyone's already inside because I'm late. And I had stopped and I had taken the walnut and wrapped it in a small box. And I said, hey, you know, I give a little speech to the family about how Wayne sort of represents like the best in our family. And he was the person. He was always kind of everyone's lodestar on how to behave right, how to put other people first. And then I gave him the gift and he opened up and he looked at his walnut and he was completely perplexed. And I said, the rest of your gift is outside. And I went outside and I said, well, this is the rest of your gift. And he's looking around like he doesn't see it. And then I said, no, right over there. And then he realizes, that's when the moment hits him. And he's like, he runs up to the car and he looks at me and he goes, this is for me. And he was completely, he was frozen. I was too. And it's like, this isn't a gift, Wayne. This is just returning something you loaned me for 37 years, right? I didn't see it as anything other than trying to put everything back to zero. I felt like I had been in debt on this one. And he turns around, he starts crying and he hugs me, and everyone in the family then starts crying and it becomes kind of a mess. And then his wife, Kathy, who's been my sister-in-law for most of my life, Kathy comes over and says, this is like, she said, I've never seen him react like this. I think that, and I don't think it was because he missed the car so much. I think what he caught a really good break when he needed one. And I don't know that I appreciated how important the timing was. And I also don't know that I understood that every now and then when you're a really, really good guy, sometimes, you know, you spend so much time worrying about other people that maybe you don't always worry as much about yourself. And it was nice to have somebody do something for Wayne that he would have done for anyone else, right? And I think that in this particular case, he got a chance to have something that was purely for him. I don't know. I mean, the way my whole family reacted, I think everyone was really shocked. I'm the only one who moved away. And so I think that there are times where they wonder how much I think about them and worry about them. And it's constant. I mean, I think about them constantly. But I guess sometimes it, you know, maybe you need a little more concrete evidence of that. They all remembered the crash. They all remembered how much it bothered me. And I think they were all surprised that, you know, that I carried it around this long when no one ever gave me grief about it, because I felt like I had a long question that I had not yet answered, and I finally got it done.
Mike Lewis is a journalist in Seattle, where he also runs the Streamline Tavern in Lower Queen Anne. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and this week's theme is It's Only Money. The time is December 1931, right in the middle of the Great Depression. The place is Tenino, Washington, a little logging town south of Olympia, and the problem is serious. The Citizens Bank of Tenino has run out of money and closed its doors. It was the only bank in town, so when the bank ran out of money, the whole town ran out of money. They had businesses and customers, but no currency to exchange. So they looked around and wondered, what are we going to do now?
So they need to print money, basically.
And so that's what they did. Now, making a local currency was actually pretty common during the Depression, but the way that Tenino did it was so different, it didn't just help solve their money problem, it put them on the map. Sound Effects' Posey Gruner has the story.
Tenino resident Charles Hallett holds up a piece of the original Tenino money.
So you can see that these are hand-signed, three different colors of ink, and then you can tell December 1931 these were original.
The three men who signed the bill were all prominent Tenino businessmen.
Dr. Major, Dr. Wickman, and A.H. Meyer. Dennis, doctor, and the head publisher of the newspaper.
And they got to sign the money because, well, it was their idea. They were members of the Tenino Chamber of Commerce, and they'd come together during the crisis after the bank closed. The man who actually proposed the idea to print money was Don Major, the publisher of the Thurston County Independent. Now, this wasn't a new idea. This sort of informal local money even had a name. Scrip. Think of it like a streetcar token or a gift certificate. It's not really money, but it can be used like money and traded like money, but it can only be redeemed at certain locations. And that was how Tenino's money worked. To make the money, they used the printing press from Don Major's newspaper. And to distribute the money, they set up some terms. First, you had to have funds in the Citizens Bank of Tenino. All the accounts were frozen, of course, which is how they got into this mess in the first place. But if you signed over 25% of your bank holdings to the Tenino Chamber of Commerce, the chamber would give you an equivalent amount of Tenino money. Then you could go use it in Tenino, where the businesses had agreed to accept it. All that was fairly common, but there were two things that made Tenino's money different. First, it was legal tender. Tenino actually petitioned Congress for permission to print Tenino money, and they got it. People in Tenino claim it's the only scrip to have ever gotten this permission. Second, and this part is really crucial, Tenino's bills were made of wood. Chris Hallett shows me some of the raw material.
This is the roll of the wooden money that they used before they cut it and make wooden dollars out of it. This is the raw product.
Tenino's first run of money, in December of 1931, was printed on paper. But by the time they made a second run, early in 1932, they did something different. A man named Albert Balch had a product called slice wood, and he'd been promoting it to use as Christmas cards. Now that the holidays were over, he convinced Tenino's Chamber of Commerce to use it to print their money. It was durable, readily available, and just thin enough that they could print on it with that old newspaper press. And that's how Tenino's wooden money was born. It wasn't long before the Seattle newspapers started writing about these wooden bills. In February, the Seattle Star wrote about Tenino's wooden money. Then, the story got picked up by the Associated Press and published in newspapers all across the country. And in March, a film crew came to Tenino. They made a segment for a Universal newsreel, and it was played in theaters all across the country. Okay. It was a silent newsreel. But believe me, this is it. Audiences watched as sheets of the raw wood were hauled into the newspaper office. They saw the sheets of wood go into the press, get stamped, and come out as money. And that was the beginning of a new phase for Tenino's wooden money. As a collectible. Again, the AP covered the story.
Tenino's wooden money soared above par today, doubling in value. Tenino residents were asking $1 in United States silver or currency for their wooden 50-cent pieces, and getting it.
Tenino's wooden money had all the markings of a great collectible. It was very rare. A limited number were printed for a short time in a tiny town in Nowheresville. It could be authenticated. It was signed. It was numbered. And it was unusual. It's not every day you see a dollar made of wood. People around the country were willing to trade real money, real U.S. currency, for Tenino's wooden money. And they would pay a premium. In March 1932, a woman named Lucy from Wisconsin wrote to a woman named Catherine from Tenino. Lucy had seen Catherine's name and picture in a Wisconsin paper, and she wanted to ask a favor.
Please excuse me for taking the liberty of writing you a stranger, but I would like very much to have some of the wooden money you were using there just now for a keepsake. You can tell me what denomination you can get it in. Then I will send you the money by return mail to cover the amount I want you to send me.
And just like that, by the time the snow thawed in early April, the wooden money started flowing out of Tenino. And cash started flowing back in. Now, some might see this as a failure. Tenino's wooden money was intended to circulate within the town itself. But when it became a collectible, it started to disappear. And for the second time, Tenino was running out of money. But Don Major, the publisher, he didn't see it as a failure. Quite the opposite. In fact, the chamber started printing more money. Over the following years, it's said that the Tenino Chamber of Commerce sold $10,000 worth of wooden money. And the story goes that of that $10,000, only $40 were ever redeemed in Tenino. And all that money that came in, the Chamber of Commerce used it to buy the bank.
This is the original door.
Chris Hallett keeps his personal collection of wooden money in the vault of the old bank.
And as you see as we walk in, this is all the original walls. This is the original tumbler vault.
Today, the bank has been converted to offices. Hallett is a financial advisor, and he works out of the bank. He likes being connected to the history, and it's nice to have a vault because he has a pretty sizable collection.
I currently have one of the largest private collections that we are aware of.
He enjoys collecting the money, and he sees it as something of a personal mission. After nearly a century away from Tenino, Hallett enjoys bringing the wooden money back home.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is It's Only Money. In the summer of 2018, Layla Marie Ali declared bankruptcy. And it was a bit of a shock because she'd always been pretty responsible about money. She'd picked up a lot from her parents, generosity from her dad, savvy from her mom. The bankruptcy was largely caused by some bad breaks, but Layla started to see that there were other factors too. That she'd inherited from each parent a more complicated relationship with money than she'd realized. Layla produced an essay about her father, her mother, and money called Coincidence of Wants. She joined us to share some excerpts and some insights.
Well, I actually call him Mr. Ali. To his face, I call him Dad, but my mother has been married a few times. And so I've got a few father figures. So just to keep it all in my head straight, my mom, when she met him at the bank, she was a bank teller. She always referred to him as Mr. Ali because Sarakh was a little hard for Americans to say.
Mr. Ali. All right. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hear a little bit from your essay, A Coincidence of Wants. And this is a little excerpt about Mr. Ali and how he relates to money.
For him, there was always someone in the old country, be it Somalia or Yemen, that needed his last dollar so much more than he did. And he gave it to them. He gave it all to them. To know poverty so intimately that no matter what you have, you feel completely unworthy of keeping any of it, is a depth of understanding that he knew I would never be able to relate to, and so he didn't try. The past is the past, Baba, he would say. Why you want to go there so much? I'm a historic tour guide, I want to say. I know everyone's history but my own. Instead, I say nothing. The story I often tell myself is, why bother? He won't understand me anyway. I've never known a person to give away more money than my own father. I am both proud and frustrated by his attitude toward money. Growing up, during our brief limited visits together, if we passed a homeless person on the way to whatever restaurant we were going to, he always gave them a few singles. If he didn't have any small bills, he would save his change after the meal and go back to give his change to that person. He often dropped me off to my mother's apartment with a couple of bills, always an irregular amount. Sometimes a few 20s, other times a few 100s. Whatever he earned that day, that's what he gave. Mr. Ali paid no child support regularly. That wasn't his way. If he saw you, he gave. If he didn't, he wouldn't. It wasn't malicious, careless, or thoughtless. It was cultural. What is child support to a Somali anyway? A very strange custom for someone more familiar and comfortable with nomadic culture. Love and support is given in person. When we were together, he gave me the world as he understood it. And so when I was looking back over my life about how I actually was with money, I was probably the most thrifty person in my family. And this has to do with how generous my father was with me, because he would send me home with any amount of money that he had. And because all of my needs were already taken care of by my mother, I would come home and I'd show her the money that my dad had given me, because my dad would tell me to give it to her. And my mother would always look at it and just say, go put that away. And so what does that even mean to a five-year-old? I just hid it somewhere in my room, maybe put it in a drawer or something. But it was never something I was expected to use in any way. And so I became a saver at a very early age. And so when I did go bankrupt, it was odd to me because I've always thought of myself as a thrifty person. And as for my father and that relationship, watching him give away so much money, I always got upset with him. And I remember thinking, this man is taking care of what felt to me like an entire village in two countries and not taking care of us as well as he could be.
So on the subject of debt, that seems to relate a lot to the other half of this essay, or the other piece in this sort of couplet, which is about your mother.
Right.
So tell me just like a little bit about her and what she looks like and stuff.
So her name is Charlene. She's short, like me. She's about 4'11", and a little dynamo. And what I know of money primarily comes from her, but both of my parents, I would have to say, are examples of what not to do with money.
Yeah. Well, you write so beautifully about Charlene. I wonder if we could hear an excerpt of this. This is, again, from your essay, A Coincidence of Wants.
All right. This is back when she was Mama Bush. At the end of the month, Charlene would help her mother come up with increasingly creative ways to rob Peter in order to pay Paul. Making a dollar out of 15 cents was more birthright than skill in the projects, but there were many rules to the game, rest assured. Mama always had a method to her madness. Rule number one, always pay the rent in full and on time. Rule number two, always pay friends and family before creditors. That also happens to be the code of the street. Always take care of the neighborhood, and the neighborhood will always take care of you. Outside of that, anything goes. She learned to float by just making minimum payments to creditors, and if the minimum was too high, she learned to call for a rate adjustment. If multiple bills were owed at roughly the same time, she called the creditors first and worked out a payment plan. Pay each of them half of whatever fraction you can manage, but pay it on time. All things through communication. On time was a big deal. Where she was short on cash, she was long on integrity. If Charlene could talk to you, she could always negotiate a deal. This ability to intuitively see through the capitalist matrix of the U.S. economy, to know intimately that the value of something is artificial and arbitrary, that we assign value to objects, and that objects don't assign values to themselves, felt like a superpower. You want $50? Charlene said, nah, bruh. I'll give you $25 today, and you can hit me up next month plus interest. And people trusted her because she was a woman of her word. Layla, be true to your word, she said. It's all you have. Because when they stop believing you, you done.
Thank you for reading that. That seems like a kind of pretty sophisticated way to handle debt.
To have that level of skill with money at such a young age is phenomenal. But where that didn't serve her, I think, is ego or cockiness, because she got so good at it that she took more risk than she could possibly handle. I mean, it was a juggling act. And if one ball fell, then the whole thing fell apart, you know? And that, I watched that happen to her on more than one occasion growing up. Well, she as a parent reminds me of the father in that film, Life is Beautiful, about the kid in the Holocaust and how he made a game of the whole thing. So we were impoverished. I was born in a homeless shelter for abused women. There were times when we didn't have enough food, but life was a game for Charlene. And one instance in particular I'm thinking of was we didn't have enough milk. And without missing a beat, she just went in the freezer, got the ice cream, put it in a bowl, and poured Cheerios on top. And you couldn't tell me and my brother that we hadn't won the lottery that day. So those are the kinds of creative things that she would do. And in that way, I think a lot of my creativity comes from her and having to think outside of the box.
If part of this bigger project was to excavate your own history a little bit and understand how it got you where you're at now, what did you find, like, around the bankruptcy?
That probably had to do with college. I had the loans, but I also ran into trouble with my parents' divorce, my mother and my stepfather in particular. There were some loans in my name, some loans in their name. And when they got divorced, neither one of them wanted the debt. At some point, I owed, let's say, $5,000. And I had something like 3 or 4 business days to come up with it. And I called my parents and, you know, they were going through their own problems. So my mother suggested going and getting a credit card. And that was the first time I ever got into debt. And then it just snowballed. Here's the crazy thing with bankruptcy. When I applied, my credit score was very high, like 780 or something. So that's where that integrity comes in. I paid those debts and I paid them for a long time, on time. Now that's my mother. Just like her, moving around the debt, robbing Peter to pay Paul, calling, negotiating for different rates as needed. This is what made me feel like a good person. I knew I was a good person because I took care of my responsibilities. It's just that the debt was too much for my income and for who I was. And I was never, ever, ever going to get ahead. But if you face it and you go, I'm never going to win this game. This game is rigged against me. All of a sudden, I was like, I can forgive myself for this. And I knew I was going to end up, my dad is poverty stricken right now. So he's an old man living the way he grew up. But I was able in the process to separate the emotion from what's happening. So when you think about what is money, it's a tool, but it's also an agreement. It's a huge societal agreement that the number printed on this bill is what we say it is. What I remember is I was simply breaking an agreement. It's like breaking a promise. And that doesn't feel good, and you don't want to break your promises. But if you've ever been a parent, you know sometimes you break your promises and then you restore your integrity. And so that's what I did. That's how I view the bankruptcy. It's just a broken promise. I can't pay this back. I'm not going to. I'm going to know that I'm a good person, to let this go, and then restore my integrity by setting up a better plan. So this thing in life happened to me, and I could keep paying the sins of my parents, or I could just forgive. Forgive them, forgive myself, and just let that be.
Layla Marie Ali is a tour guide, performer, and writer in Seattle. It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and the theme today is It's Only Money. If you've ever ordered something at a restaurant, only to have your eyes bug out when you get the bill, this last story is for you. It comes from KNKX's Ed Ronco, and it takes place at the intersection of capitalism, etiquette, and ethics. In other words, in a bar. We asked Ed to come in and tell me the tale. Ed, hey man, welcome.
Hi, Gabriel.
So where does this story start?
Okay, mid-December. My partner David and I, we go out with another couple we know, Chris and Chris. And I think for the purposes of this story, it'll just be easier if we refer to them as collectively the Chrises.
The Chrises.
And we go to a show to see Judy Collins perform. And she was great. I mean, great.
I woke up, it was a Chelsea morning. First thing that I heard
Afterward, we went to get a nightcap, and we walked to a nearby establishment, and we find this table in the back. It is a Friday night. It's busy. And you know, Gabriel, we're in like a nice place. It's not super fancy, but it's not a dive. And I'm not going to name this place because this is not really a story about this bar. As you'll hear, this is more about ethics. And I'm going to let my friend Chris tell some of this story.
So I looked up and noticed there was a giant chalkboard that listed this thing that just said rare and interesting whiskeys. And I can't remember the exact brands, but like one of them was a 30 and one was a 35.
Year 35 years of
yes.
aging.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We assumed, well, that's going to be a $50 or $60 shot. It won't be cheap, but it won't be bad. And I look at the board and say, oh, we'll do this 30 and this 35. Because it looked interesting. And who doesn't like a nice, interesting whiskey after seeing Judy Collins? I mean,
right.
Come on. So we order that.
So $50, $60, that sounds like a lot of money for an ounce of liquor or whatever.
That's a lot, but you know, it's right before Christmas. They're just beginning 3 weeks off of work, so it's a special occasion. We're kind of celebrating, and they kind of thought, why not?
They're splurging on it.
They're okay. splurging, yeah. David and I, we each get a Manhattan. The bartender goes away, and he comes back very quickly with a couple bottles and some Glencairn glasses, which are those nice fancy teardrop-shaped ones. Mm. And he pours two shots, one from each bottle, and he says to the Chrises, do you want some for your friends to try too? And one of the Chrises says, yeah, sure, why not? And so the bartender pours a third shot. We pass them around, we sip. I'm also noticing that there are no menus on our table, and we're getting kind of a lot of attention from the bartender for as busy as this place is. So I grab a menu from a neighboring table and I look up the price. Two of the shots were $235 each.
Oh.
And the third, just the shot, was about $430.
$430.
That's madness.
It is. It's unbelievable. And I tell the Chris is what I saw in this moment. And here's Chris again.
I just remember at some point, things kind of fading out, and I'm a little blank on what proceeds next, but I just remember grabbing the menu from at one point and going, you've got to be joking.
like those scenes in movies where the main character is like the shots centered on the main character and the background kind of disappears.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit of vertigo myself. So this is like, just to put this in perspective, these are 1 to whatever 1.5 ounce shots that cost as much as like a round trip ticket to Los Angeles.
Yeah, I mean, if you poured all of these together, you would have what, like a quarter of a cup of coffee that costs as much as a beginning laptop computer.
Almost $1,000.
Yeah.
So, and this was obviously not something that they had were expecting, and this is not something they're used to doing. They're not like high rolling.
No, they just, you know, I mean, a $50 or $60 drink like they had thought they were buying was a big deal for them.
I mean, if I could just imagine, if it was me, I would order what I assumed to be an expensive shot, and I would think to myself, what a sophisticated grown up I am. And then as soon as this happened, I'd be like, oh no, I'm just a dumb kid.
Yeah, I mean, they have a good sense of humor about it, but I think in the moment there was a little bit of oh no, and also thank God we're with good friends who are only going to tell the story with our permission.
So they ordered this stuff. This adds up to many hundreds of dollars, and there was no like price listed on this chalkboard, right? Am I clear on that?
That's right. No price on the chalkboard, no menus on the table at the time the order was taken, which was very soon after we walked in the door. And they told the bartender about this, you know, hey, we're not going to run out the door or anything, but we didn't really realize what we were getting into. And the bartender took away one of the shots.
Was he annoyed?
He seemed a little annoyed. He did point out that the chalkboard said rare and special scotches or something like that. So he took away one of the shots, one of the $235 ones. And, you know, I was kind of two minds on this. On one hand, it's maybe a little foolhardy to go in and just kind of point an order without knowing what you're ordering. On the other hand, I felt like the bartender could have found an artful way to warn us about what we were ordering.
Give you a little heads up. This is not a normal shot of Glenlivet or
yes.
whatever. This is a many hundreds of dollars, you know, right home about kind of shot.
That's right. That's right. And I asked Chris how he felt about that. Did you feel like the bar was fair to you?
Whew. Well, it's such a hard question to answer.
Yeah, I have to say my initial sympathies, at least, are definitely with you and the Chris's. But on the other hand, I see the point that you were really responsible for your own actions, right? And you shouldn't order something if you don't know how much it costs. So it's kind of a dilemma. Like, I don't even know who you'd ask to get to the bottom of something like that.
Luckily, we found an expert bartender. Robbie McGrath is his name. He works at Matt's in the Market. It's this fine dining place near Pike Place Market in Seattle. And to be perfectly clear, again, this is not where this all happened. We've asked Robbie to kind of be our industry expert, our neutral party here. He's been bartending for 45 years. He's been written about, and he loves his job.
Well, it's like a one-act play every day. So I really enjoy interacting with guests, making them happy. I tried to leave it one time for about 3 months, and it didn't work. I like what I do. And a guest can smell that on you, I think.
I was really curious what his sort of verdict would be here. You know, should the bartender have told us the price? Was it foolhardy to just point an order? So I told him the story I just told you. And surprisingly to me, his answer was very simple.
My first reaction is just a little bit of anger. Our industry shouldn't be pulling that crap. That's not how we operate as an industry.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So I'm a little surprised too. I kind of thought he would, you know, maybe side with the bartender.
So I pushed back on him a little bit and said, you know, what about not wanting to insult a customer? What about not wanting to imply they can't afford the product? And he says it's all about making sure the customer is just fully aware, just has all of the information they need so that they can make an informed choice, and no matter who they are.
If Bill Gates came into my bar and ordered a scotch and it was $240, I would say, just so you know, we're very proud of this scotch and we charge this for it. That would be his choice at that point. Maybe he would rather spend $40 and donate the other $200. I mean, it's just, I think that was really poorly handled, in my opinion.
And of course, I called him and told him the story a little bit ahead of time so that he'd have time to think about it. So he talked it over with some colleagues. And they agree with him, too.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. So the Chris's are kind of ethically off the hook?
Ethically off the hook, but still financially on the hook. They did pay the bill, which was?
$991.95.
Gah!
Is it funny yet?
You know, yeah, at the end of the day, really. I mean, who does that?
Was there a lesson learned?
Always wait for the menu. Rule one, or ask questions.
And Robbie McGrath again says the owner should be made aware of what happened. I am going to leave that up to the Chris's. This was their bill. But the bottom line, he says, is that it is the bar's responsibility to make sure you know what you're purchasing.
Wow. So I got to ask you, I mean, how did it taste? Did it taste like, you know, the milk of a unicorn or something?
It wasn't bad, but it didn't taste like $400 to me. And I should add, I have no idea what $400 would even taste like.
Well, thanks a lot to the Chris's for being brave enough to share this story. And Ed, thank you for getting to the bottom of this for us.
Cheers.
L'chaim. Ed Ronco hosts All Things Considered here on KNKX. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Ed Ronco and Kari Ploeg. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. After all this money drama, it's nice to know that some things are still free, namely our podcast. Find it wherever you get your audio, and we always appreciate feedback. Send it to soundeffect@knkx.org. Meet you back here next week when our theme is Family Matters. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.